Yeah, it's happening. Welcome to Lang Time Chat, episode 65,
We think.
the white circle with the gray
Well,
square
down here it's
in
showing you it's
between it.
recording.
Oh, that too. But it's the white circle with the gray square inside of it
If
that
we want
tells
to
you it's
know what's
recording.
taking up so much space in our data plan, look at how many megabytes it is for 20 seconds. Like this is it.
No,
It's these
I
videos.
know. We can go back and delete them. Actually, we have the storage space on langtimestudio.com. We can just throw
Throw
everything there.
everything.
Anyway, yes, welcome to this episode of Lang Time Chat. I'm going to ignore how unintuitive that icon is for you are being recorded. There's nothing about a circle with a square inside it that says you are being recorded. And today we are chatting with our own Citizen Kane, Jonathan.
Hello. I definitely never heard that
And is that sarcastic? Have people called you that?
Yes,
Okay.
I have heard it, yes.
Wow. All right. I was just making sure. That's good. What a fun life for you.
Do you
Oh
like being
yeah.
unoriginal?
Yeah.
Okay.
There are plenty of puns. They happen a lot.
Remember Kano?
Now you're going to be trying to think of them throughout the rest of the recording.
From the original Mortal Kombat? Were you alive during the original Mortal Kombat?
I have no idea when that would have been.
1993, 94.
I'm gonna say no.
The part of it, then, yes, depends on when exactly in there it was.
Oh, delightful with you young folk. Anyway, all right. So, welcome to this, and really, it's just completely free form here. Basically, the floor is yours, John. What are we here to
Okay.
discuss?
I think at some point I joked that I would just come on and have you tell me what to talk about, and that isn't exactly what's happening, but it's not that far.
That's good.
So the basic idea I wanted to talk about was something a little different, I think, for Langtime Studio, which is the idea of conlanging in a non-diachronic method way. Because that's something that I don't see people talking about very much, like on the Discord and in chat during live streams. And I think it would be interesting to talk about that sort of like other side of conlanging, and I can get into some specifics with some of the projects, depending on how the timing works out, because I have a few of those that I've done, and I sort of, in my history of conlanging, I have kind of gone back and forth between these different methods, and I think it's always nice to have different perspectives on that, so
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I think that's largely because we have a very specific project we're doing on Langtime Studio. It's not like we're
Well, I mean, I don't mean just what you talk about, but what other people in the community talk about too. I mean, the very, very large majority of conlangs I see talked about on the Langtime Studio Discord are, developed diachronically, and to the point where, I have a couple projects where they're not, and sometimes I'll bring one of them up and I'll like ask for an idea or something like that, and I always get suggestions like, "Well, have it evolve from this." I'm like, "Thank you, but no, it doesn't quite work in this case."
Well,
So.
a lot of times where you see that a lot is with both Angellangs and experimental languages, both of which
Yeah.
I have a soft spot for. The latter more than the former, though I guess it's really hard to distinguish between the two when you come right down to it. Anyway.
Those classifications are always a little bit difficult for me, I feel like, because maybe it's just because I'm never going for just one thing with a conlang. There's always some experimental aspect to it, at least for myself, even if it's all trodden ground for other people. So, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I would actually love if you'll allow. Let's go back before getting to that. Where and how did you start conlanging?
There's probably two different answers to that.
That's fine.
One of them is that I was just very into Lord of the Rings as a child,
Okay.
and I know that is a very common experience for conlangers, and I at some point made up an alphabet. I honestly don't remember how far I got with it. I might have made some words and things like that. I think I probably did. you know, I was interested in like drawing maps and things because that was like a whole big thing. There's, you know, maps of Middle Earth and all that. And so I had to label them in some way. But I didn't do very much with that. And I sort of stopped after not very long. I was still into Lord of the Rings, but it was like a bit of a phase.
How old were you around this time?
Well, this would have been right around when the movies were coming out, which I think was 2001 was the first one.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then the third one in 2003. So 8 to 11-ish, maybe somewhere in there.
Okay.
Because I remember for sure that I read the books. I started reading the books after the first movie came out, but I finished after the second movie came out. I was trying to finish them before, and I didn't quite make it. So then quite a bit later, when I was, I think, a freshman in college, my sister, who was a couple years older than me, was taking a linguistics course.
Ooh.
And she found out about this idea of conlanging from somewhere. And she said, "This sounds like a fun thing. Do you want to make one of these together?" And it began as a collaborative thing, and I basically just took over. Like, it was very quickly clear that I was way more into it than she was. And I still have, it was like a Google Docs shared thing, so I still have those files and stuff. I was looking back at them recently. Nice. But also, I sort of started with scripts more than language.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, a friend of mine in college showed me that she had made a script, which I think was just a cipher.
Mm-hmm.
But she would take notes in it in classes, and I was like, "Oh, that's a really fun idea." So I made a cipher like that, and I still have it completely memorized. This is 2011. I still use it from time to time.
Nice.
I made a few others like that for English, and then from there, I sort of started doing scripts for conlang. So that's one of the parts that I really like the most about it, which is why I basically always have scripts for my languages, even if it maybe should make more sense that they would not be written.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's awesome, though.
By the way, that I still, in fact, Meg Davies' script is the only one that I can write in, and I can still write in it.
Yeah, I have a few. For a while, I was like doing a diary or a journal or something. I was trying to do it very regularly in a couple of these scripts, and that fell off more because I just wouldn't remember to write consistently or didn't have anything to write about. But I like making scripts even if it's not for conlang. I have quite a few of those also.
Yeah.
Nice.
Cool. All right. So then now let's move ahead a little bit. What was well, you can tell me if I'm asking this wrong. I was going to say, what was your first experimental language?
I don't know. I don't know. How exactly would you define that term? Because I'm always a little bit fuzzy on the boundaries of those
categories. I think an engineered language, the specific definition of an engineered language, is one that takes a very, very specific linguistic goal and attempts to achieve that goal. Whether that goal has anything to do with with, you know, naturalism, the sound, or whatever, it's usually this very hard line, usually kind of oddball goal, and then you're attempting to create a language around it in any number of ways. And these can be achieved using, I can say, like, small n, you know, more naturalistically and less naturalistically. So if you look at Ithquil, which is an engineered language, there's nothing very natural about that, either in its sound or the way that its grammar works. If you look at Kaylin, this is another one that has a very hard top-line engineered goal. But it's like, okay, with this unrealistic goal, what's kind of a naturally realistic-y way to approach this goal? But it's still starting with an unrealistic goal, something that languages don't do because they don't have to. So that's my idea of what an engineered language is. Where I kind of separate experimental languages is when they try to achieve a goal with something that doesn't use the same kind of phenomenon or phenomenology or whatever of natural languages. So both Ithquil and Kaylin are spoken languages, right?
Right.
Even though they're unrealistic, they are spoken languages, which is something that you wouldn't be surprised to find on Earth. Even with something like, you know, I have KNSL, which is the sign language version of Kelenala. Both of those are engineered languages. One of them is spoken, one of them is signed, but again, not surprising to see a spoken or a signed language. Something like Sdefa is something that you don't see, that you would not expect to find on Earth. And so all of those are engineered languages, but I would separate Sdefa off as experimental simply because it's not something that you would find naturally occurring, even if its grammar were naturalistic.
So that's yeah. Idea. Okay, so in that sense, then, I think of the actual ongoing projects, Defa would be the first. But I have done a few sketches of written only languages, sort of not exactly patterned out off of, but inspired by Unnles, which is honestly one of my favorite conlangs. So I have one of those, which is sort of technically still active, but I haven't worked on it in a while. And I have a few sketches which may predate Stefa.
Have you ever shared these?
Yes, I have.
Where?
Both on Discord and on my blog.
What are the names?
It doesn't have one. I don't know how.
Well,
I'm bad at coming up with names for things. I can link to you where I've shared it before.
You should, and you should come up with a name so that you can refer to it, even if it's Project 12 and Project 14.
Yeah. And then there's another one, which is a more recent one, which would definitely fall into this category, which I don't know how to describe. It's a spoken language. But it, do you know, Gokjam? I'm not sure how you say that exactly. It's one of the cursed conlangs. It was used in the last year's, YouTube relay.
Uh-huh.
It was inspired by that. This is a relatively recent project. I shared a bit about it on Discord. It's spoken, but the actual words do not line up with what you say exactly. It's there's like this level of, how do I even describe this? The language itself is a binary code. So each word is a sequence of ones and zeros, and there are, you know, some affixes and things. And the way that those codes are determined is a whole other thing that isn't exactly relevant to this. But then, there's essentially like an algorithm for converting a binary code into a sequence of syllables. But different syllables have different lengths of code. And so the boundaries between syllables or apparent words do not coincide with the boundaries between the actual words in the code. So what that means is if you change one word, like if you change something from first to second person or something like that, it may affect the entire text after that, if one code is slightly shorter or longer, or if the syllable that it is translated into takes fewer or more bits. So those are the three sort of categories, I guess, of experimental languages that I've worked on. And then the one that I sort of assumed that I would be talking about the most for this is Toel, which is not exactly experimental, but is definitely engineered and had a very particular goal or set of goals.
Yeah, why don't you talk about what those goals are?
Yeah, so, well, to back up a little bit.
Sure.
As I sort of, like, was plotting my way through beginner conlang base, where I, you know, started off with just like a list of words and basic word order, and that was what it was, you know. And then I sort of started to learn more about phonology and syntax and things like that, and those got sort of more sophisticated, but I wasn't really doing anything with the diachronic method until a certain point. And then I was sort of like imitating diachronic processes, but it was more like hinting at them, but only actually doing it as a surface level synchronic thing. So like I would say, oh, the suffix surfaces in these different ways depending on what precedes it, but I didn't have any actual sound changes that resulted in those alternations. I just knew what sorts of things sometimes showed up in languages. And then at a certain point, I was like, okay, well, this is like the thing that people do. Let me give this a try, and failed miserably because it turned out that sound changes are really complicated. And the more, in my experience, the more you learn in conlang, the more you learn you don't know. And it's sort of like, it became a bit of a feedback loop of like, how can I possibly make any decision if I don't know everything that's like lower down or everything that might come from it? And it was sort of, it was very difficult to make anything. I was sort of caught between these two impulses of like wanting to have this conlang be, you know, existent and work in a particular way and not having any idea how to get there without spending like 90% of my time reading about things that I didn't even know what topics those were yet. So at a certain point I said, enough with that. I would like to have an actual conlang, because I had started probably dozens by that point and had nothing that I was satisfied with. I'm going to ignore that method entirely, make something that is very straightforward, but actually exists. And so for me, Tolol is basically the embodiment of perfect is the enemy of good, or there's a few variants in that phrase, where I decided it's not going to be perfect for sure, it's not going to be at all realistic, but it will exist, and I will have a language that I can do things with. And so some specific goals going into that were simplicity. I wanted it to be easy to make and easy to use so that I could basically just get off the ground in the first place. So it's entirely regular. There's no, like, there's basically no inflection. There's no irregular verbs, irregular nouns, or anything like that. You don't mark plural or tense or anything like that unless you need, you know, specifically want to. There's a few other basic things, but like the idea was there would be this very simple set of grammar rules and everything would go from that. So you wouldn't have like an expression like, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but something where, you know, like all the time in natural languages, you get some little fixed phrase that grammatically doesn't really track because it's inherited from something or has been smushed down from something else. Basically, everything would be
English, like,
regular grammatically.
To make something by hand.
Right.
And it's...
Yeah.
You just never use an article with that noun, even though most of the time you're using articles with nouns, especially singular nouns. That's... anyway, just an example of something that's odd.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing that I wanted to avoid, because I wanted it to be something where, like, I could actually learn to use it in a relatively quick time frame. And so it is not developed with a diachronic method, as I've said. I basically decided on a phonology that I liked, a set of sounds, and I went through and I decided here are the phonotactic rules, which I have a big chart that says, you know, here are all the clusters that are allowed at the beginning of a word, all the ones that are allowed in the middle of a word, and all the ones that could occur at word boundaries. It's got very, I mean, I guess all languages are strict with their phonotactic rules for the most part, but, I actually, there was a previous attempt that I think right around the time that I started watching, Langtime Studio, I was working on, and I joined, I shared some things about that, and then that was quickly replaced by Tolol. So, yeah, I can talk about that a little more specifically if you want, about, like, how the basic grammar of it works. But the idea of the language was to have something that was usable. And then once I had that established and I had done some translations and I was sort of having fun with it, then I was able to go back to attempting an evolved naturalistic conlang, and it was actually a very like freeing experience, because it was sort of like, no matter how this goes, I have this thing already, you know. I think for a lot of people, I see this in various places, but I definitely see it a lot on Discord, is like a lot of people are like, well, I have to, this language has to be perfect. I need to get everything right. I need to know all the precedent and natlangs for this phenomenon or whatever it is. And then it just ends up stuck in development for a very long time. And I think for some of the people who, you know, are in that situation, it might be worthwhile to just set that aside for a little bit and make something else. For me, it was very, very helpful. So
I've always thought that a language should be appropriate to its setting. And so if you go through and like look at, you know, all the languages, especially that I've done that have diachrony, it's because the setting calls for it. If you ever look at any language I've ever created where I was creating it either for myself or to be used as an experiment, there's no diachrony, not because, you know, it was necessarily something that was freeing or anything, but because it doesn't make sense, you know? So it's like,
I mean,
here, what I mean to suggest is, if you're creating a language for yourself in the sense that you actually want to use it, right? There's not really like a simulated history to create, because it's just your history, right?
Well, I think for a lot of people, they like the idea of having a naturalistic language, and that sort of for them necessarily means having evolved it. And I think a lot of the times the setting comes after. It comes because as you start making these words and developing a lexicon, you think, oh, well, where is my term for whatever going to come from? And then you end up learning about the history of the speakers in that way. And I think that's a perfectly good way to go about that also. I think it can get complicated, and it is a lot slower. And I know at some point you said or wrote or something about like, that translation into a conlang should take a long time. I don't remember exactly how you phrased it, but like, if you're doing it right, that is kind of a difficult thing, and it might take a very long time to translate a sentence. And I agree that that is true if you're going with that kind of language, but, you know, one of the goals, like I said, with Tolo was like, I want it to be relatively easy. I want, just because it's just nice to be able to do this, you know. It was sort of like, like one of the things I do with the language at this point, I mean, I'm always making new words for it, but the grammar is done because it's very simple. I'll like find a random post on the internet that I think is funny, and I'll decide to translate it. And yes, it does sometimes take a while, but often it's very straightforward, and it's sort of like, there's this little sense of accomplishment, like, you know, I made this thing, even as small as it might be, just like a tweet or something, you know.
Well, I do think, though, it can be really hard to talk about conlangs as a whole, just because it's not just that there are these different, you know, the typology of conlangs, where we've got, you know, artlangs versus naturalistic, or within artlangs, we've got naturalistic versus, like, you know, different purposes, naturalish, if you will. Within, you know, engineered languages, you could have the same kind of, like, naturalistic tendencies, or, you know, completely bucking all norms of language. So it's like not just the typology that we have in the world of conlanging, but it's also the goals that we have for conlanging. And
yeah,
one of the things, like when we talk about translation, we're usually talking about professional projects.
Yes.
If we don't think about how we're translating a professional project, I would say we're not doing our job. And so if we're like, oh, word for word, they want this translated, we're just going to word for word, boom, 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 go down the line in English to Jacobza or English to whatever. And that, to me, is not doing our job. However, if I'm working in my own personal languages, and some of my languages are absolutely have no diachronics behind them, and not just be the setting would call for diachronics if I were being honest. But I didn't do it that way because that just wasn't my goal. My goal was to create something for me and for my purposes. And so, yeah, at that point, like, if I wanted to create a sign for my students that said, welcome to my office. And I did not want to spend a whole lot of time trying to think, how would this world, which kind of lacks history and depth, say the word office? And so I just made a word that was like, that's office. And it was fine because, like, that is not something that I'm trying to say, this is my career. This is a professional project that other people are going to be approaching and trying to treat as a natural-like language. And so I think that also needs to be acknowledged because it's, yeah, absolutely. Translation doesn't have to be hard if your goal is, I'm making this for me. I'm having some fun with this project. I just want to see this thing that I'm working with. And absolutely, yeah, it could be a different process. The minute you take it to that level of you want it to seem like it came out of another world rather than an English speaker, you know, speaking world, that's when it takes longer. And that includes with natural languages. Natural languages, I can sit here and try to translate something into Finnish, but I promise you it's going to be English based versus a Finnish speaker trying to say, well, here's the idea you're trying to say in English. Here's how we would actually express it in that same kind of context in Finland. And it's going to be very different from what I could come up with. And I think that's sort of the difference we're creating here is like, is it a translation that came out of an English-based world? And if that's your goal, then fine. But the minute you want to say this sounds like it came in world from this context, you've got to like kind of destroy the syntax of it and go into the meaning behind it. And that takes time, even if it's an existing language where you already have all the vocabulary you're going to need to do this.
Yeah, I think part of the reason I wanted to bring this up is what people are seeing, I think, in the community a lot is these very polished projects and or people working on diachronic conlangs in very detailed ways. And I think they sort of see that and think, oh, well, that's the way to do it. That's the way I have to do it. Mm-hmm. And I basically want to say, no, it isn't. You can do whatever you want. But like, I think even if you are really interested in that method, try another one. And because what I've found is like after making several or, you know, working on several conlangs in sort of different mediums and with different levels of naturalism and things like that, they all inform each other. Like it gives me ideas for Valia, which is a naturalistic-ish one. You know, it's got some quirks I know are not quite realistic, but I've gotten ideas for that language from working on other ones that are not at all meant to be like that. So, yeah.
It really depends on the purpose. Also, translation is easier the better you are with both languages.
That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just true.
as to your point on Finnish, I mean, I've been learning Yiddish for a while now. I've sort of been very slowly plodding along, but at this point, I'm reading some books and things like that. And every once in a while, there's phrasing, because the language, I mean, it's such a closely related language to English. Mm-hmm. And even so, sometimes the way that an idea is expressed is just so not what I would have thought. And like, I can express the same thing in Yiddish with what is essentially the English point of view. But that's not the idiomatic way to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, there was an example that I just came across where it was something about talking about the people of the town. And that's very easy to do more or less word for word into Yiddish. But the actual way it was phrased was something like the townish people. Nice. And it's like, that would never have occurred to me to say it that way, even though I know those words. And there's always like little things like that can come up. So
it's translation is kind of like, it's really own and separate art form that you can go into deeply or not. And it's also something that, and I think this part of it is a shame that, you know, conlangers, you know, we create languages because we enjoy it. And I think some will assume that they naturally should be as good at translation into a language insofar as they have studied or created it. And that's not necessarily true. Like translation itself, the act is something that you can get better with as you go along. And it can be difficult. And you could also be a really good conlanger who either is not very good at or does not particularly enjoy translation. Incidentally, that's something I've discovered about myself. I don't like translation. I appreciate it. I understand how difficult it is. I just don't enjoy it. And then that's
interesting.
And that's what I end up having to do the most of, is translating.
That surprises me.
It's like, but then it's like when I sit down and actually start, you know, creating the conlang, it's like, oh God, yeah, I love this. This is so much fun. It's just the translation that's work. Ugh.
I swear half the time though, it's because, you know, when you have to translate, it's usually not what you would choose to translate into the language.
That's also true.
And so, you know, what we do anyway. So like, if you're just like sitting down and like, ooh, I want to translate something into my language, you can either write an original text that's like fitting for the world or your language, or you could like find something that you're really passionate about. Like, I love this turn of phrase in English. How would I do that in my language? Like, something that excites you versus someone just giving you a bunch of lines and saying, well, you have to translate this because this is what we've decided they're saying. And, yeah. You know,
and it's, that would definitely make a big difference.
Not always fitting. And sometimes it's like, really? This is what?
Get anonymous Tumblr requests. How do you translate die fart butt into Valyrian? It's like, I don't want to.
So you don't.
Oh, no. And it's like, I can't even figure that out, and I don't want to. It's just terrible. Anyway.
You know someone's getting that tattooed.
I know. That's the thing. It's like, they like, I don't want you to do that either. Please. Oh, goodness.
So anyway.
When it comes to, but especially if I go through and I think of, like, you know, all the languages I've created, which are the languages that, if I could, I would want to actually use in my real life. The one I always come back to, without a doubt, is Kelenala, which is the minimalist language I created in 2001. Or maybe it was early 2002. The whole thing was a process that began in 2001. It's because, you know, I love the phonology. I know all the words because it's only got like 300 some words. It's 366. I absolutely love what I did with the grammar, because like just to share briefly why this came about, you know, this was whole thing was an experiment that started with my Pigeons and Creoles class, where I was like, well, what if we just gave people a list of words and no grammar? And said that they could only communicate using these words, what would they do? You know, I ran this little experiment, and that's what I wrote my paper on in 2001. And basically, as they were doing it, I just kept looking at it saying, gosh, you guys are terrible at this. Like, I gave you so many words here that you could do so much with grammatically, and you're doing that? Like, come on. I did an expanded version of that in like a class form. That was in the fall of 2002. Same situation. It's like, come on. I never said, like, for example, I never said you couldn't use reduplication. I never said you couldn't use partial reduplication. Why didn't you do this? Anyway, and I was like, well, obviously I should just create my own language, giving myself roughly the same rules. And I did it, and I loved it, and it was so cool. I love this language. That's the one I would want to use. And I mean, naturally, there's no diachrony in there because it doesn't make sense to the project. But even without that, it doesn't mean that there isn't derivation, you know, and that there. So essentially, it's like you're just starting it at year zero, right? And kind of like carving your own path with this language and just making it your own, because the history is the one you're writing in the present, and it's entirely personal, you know, it's just your own. It's not like, how would a people come up with a word for ice cream? It's like, here's my stuff. What do I want for this? And by the way, naturally, since it was my language, there had to be a root for ice cream. I didn't think it should be derived. I think it should have its own word. So I did. Chocolate too.
Obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, that's, I guess it's a matter of like how you enjoy both the creative process of creating a language and also how you enjoy using the language, right? So like for me, it's a very fun and like satisfying thing to go into any of these languages, either the Langtang languages or like languages like High Valyrian and things like that. It's very satisfying to go in and create new words. And with High Valyrian, even though it has to cut off at some point, it's enjoyable for me to think up a new glyph for that, because it's like a logography. And so that's a lot of fun. What isn't fun for me, but what is kind of fun for other people, is deciding like, okay, how do you like, oh, I want to like, because people are doing this, like I want to translate Game of Thrones into High Valyrian. I'm like, go for it. That sounds miserable to me. Like that sounds absolutely miserable. And then, you know, people are saying like, how can I use it in my daily life? It's like, well, I didn't think about that because I don't really care. That doesn't sound like fun to me, you know, but it does to others who just like, and then like for them, it's like, by the way, okay, this is getting really far afield. For them, it's like, all right, we got to separate out and say, okay, you know, obviously when I'm creating High Valyrian, I'm creating it for a very, very specific world and time and place. So obviously there aren't going to be any canon Valyrian words for things that you need, like computer, cell phone, airplane, things like that. But it is just a language. So like, if you want to use it like that, there's derivational strategies. Like, go for it. Come up with something that you think makes sense for airplane and then use it. That's fine. It's not ever going to be canon, but that's because it doesn't make sense in that context. But that doesn't mean like you can't use it, you can't do it. And it's like, I also was like, and it doesn't mean like I don't approve of it. I do, but I also don't enjoy it. So don't take that as condemnation. Please do it. I think it's really, really cool. It sounds tedious to me because that's not how I have fun with language, you know? But it doesn't mean it's like a bad, or it also doesn't mean it's not an interesting thing or it's not a cool thing. I don't know. Anyway, but I guess all of that is to say, it's made me sad that I feel like some of specifically what I have done with my career has given the impression that I think that what I am doing is good, and if you're not doing that, it's bad. Because I think that people have gotten that impression, and that makes me very sad.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah, I mean, that was sort of like the big thing, I guess, I wanted to talk about. And also, I just remembered something. So, the last week or so, I've been trying to do a Valya word a day, coming up with new things. I've got, you know, a lot of very conspicuous gaps in the lexicon. I mean, the language is, actually, I started it, I think, just about a year ago now. And so I figured, you know, I tend to sort of like focus on one thing at a time, but I figured if I can try to just make one word every day, I will probably actually end up doing more than that, because as I try to derive things, come up with related terms, or sometimes it's just like, oh, I want to make an example sentence, but that means I need some other word for this. But the other day, I wanted to make a word for yellow. I had basic color terms for like dark blue, green as one, red and white. And those are the only ones I had, but I wanted at least yellow also. And there's a whole topic of like how color terms work and things like that. And I wanted it to be like a more recent derivation, not necessarily a root. And so I was like, oh, well, what if it comes from the name of a dye that is used to dye things yellow? And then I was like, okay, well, what would that come from? Probably some sort of a plant. And it ended up being such a rabbit hole of like, well, what kinds of plants grow in the sort of climate that this language is spoken in? And specifically, it's supposed to be based on, like, the northeastern U.S. So, like, even if it's that climate, are they actually native there? It's not actually spoken there, but it's a whole thing. And it turned out to be such a complicated question, and I, like, could not make a decision, because it was like, well, if I do choose this plant that can make a yellow dye, And then later I find out that there's another one that makes a much better yellow dye and the plant is more common. And it's like, well, why didn't they name it after that one? And there's, it became, what was that?
I said it's holy, that's why. You can't grind it up.
I mean, there's all sorts of answers you could come up with for it. But it was just like decision paralysis, which I have run into so many times, more often with beginning stages of like making sound changes or figuring out basic grammar things. But that was like one of those things that Towel as a project really like avoided, because I didn't have to worry about that part of it. I could just say, well, this word sounds nice and is a valid word. That's my word for yellow. And now I'm wondering what that is. So
I will say that is something that...
Giol.
What is it?
Giol.
G-E-O-L?
G-Y-O-L.
Oh, Giol. Okay.
Giol.
That's nice.
Which is actually very similar to a lot of like Germanic type things that are related to yellow. I don't know if that was intentional or not.
Yeah. I love those little accidents. But no, that is something that I know in my textbook I write about it a lot. Like, I swear so many times I felt like I was writing the same paragraph, because it's like, effectively, when it comes down to it, it's like, I know this is hard and I know there are like a million decisions you could make. You just have to make one and go with it. And then it's
such
like,
a hard thing to do and put into practice, even if you know that is the case.
Right. And like giving examples of, you know, natural languages where it's like, think about this compound and think about the million meanings it could have had, but we decided it meant this. And you know, that doesn't mean it's the best one out there. Like, there are some meanings I can think of for some compounds we have where I'm like, well, that would have been better. And yet here we are. And so, you know, it's really about like, yes, there will be more possibilities, but you already made that decision, move on.
Yeah. And actually, like, learning that via other projects, I've been able to apply that to Valia as well, which is really helpful. Nice. Where there's been a number of times where I'm like, I could see this going so many different ways. I'm just going to pick one. It might not be the right way to do it. There is no right way to do it. It might not be the most likely one or something like that, but I'll just go for it. And it's been working pretty well.
Yeah.
And that also started as a conlang year, conlang. And so that was one of the, like, I wasn't doing it exactly day by day, but I was following the prompts in order, and that really helped. It did. At a certain point, I stopped. I need to go back and fill in some of the gaps, but it was very good for getting started.
And I'm really glad to hear that. And it really is, by no means does anyone need to work through it from day one to day 366 in that precise order and in the precise way. And so it's like, it always makes me happy to hear how people are sort of like bouncing around and trying to make it their own. Cause it's like the prompts are there for people who just need someone to tell them, go do this today.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh man, I lost it. I lost it. Oh, well.
I will say I'm also working on a book project for conlang year. Because, you know, why stop when you finish one book? Just start another, right? And one of my goals is to be a little bit more hand-holdy in that one, where it's like you sit down for your session and it's like, not just here's a goal, but here are very specific vocabulary items. Create these. And then tomorrow you're going to create this. And like, people can obviously swap out like, okay, my world doesn't have this, so you need to find an equivalent if you're wanting to do something for a fictional world that doesn't quite match the vocabulary. But my goal is to really select vocabulary and sentence structures and ideas that could be expressed in most locations on Earth. So trying to be as generic as possible. There are, of course, extremes even on Earth where it's like you're the middle of the desert, you may not know what a pond is, but, you know, it's like really just trying to pick like the most middling kind of concepts where it's like this is going to hit most people and most kinds of environments. But it's like, it's the idea, and also to hit on your point, also present the idea that you don't have to do this diachronically. Just create something, that's your word. If you want to learn more about language evolution, you can apply that later. You can think about that later, but let's start at year zero. This is what the language is right now in this state, and move forward from there. Because it really is, so much of conlanging is you have to make a decision. and the decisions are so numerous. What word am I going to create today? How am I going to get that? You know, and it's like when you have to make all of those decisions for yourself, it can absolutely stop you in your tracks if you're not working towards some goal, or if you're not just one of those people who's always intrinsically motivated. Awesome for you if you are. Most of us struggle. And so having someone say, create these 10 words, just boom, boom, boom. That's today's session.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, say, you know, the cat drinks, boom. That's all you're going to say today. And so anyway, just working on guides, and I'm so happy to have this conversation because it's like, it's giving me fresh perspective on some of the things that I'd already been laying out in this new project. And yeah, I hope people hear this and know we hear you, and we appreciate all the work that the community is doing, because it really is so cool to see the different ideas, and even just to see like what string of sounds someone put together that they thought just felt like chair. You know, like what string of sounds did you choose for that? And like, how cool that all these different strings of sounds can refer to the same thing. And I swear Hungarian got it wrong. Sape should not be chair. It just doesn't feel like a chair. Or is it sape?
Sape is beautiful. Sape is chair.
Sape and sake should not be that close in Hungarian.
Sape, beautiful chair.
It just doesn't. It doesn't hit. Not my ears.
Sape nem sape. Chair is not beautiful.
But yeah, I want people to think more about natural languages like that too, where it's like, because so often I hear so many conlangers say like, I don't like this word. I came up with this word and now I hate how it sounds. And it's like, there are so many words in natural languages where I hear it and I go, really? That's what we went with.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like that just happens. And that doesn't mean the language is not beautiful, is not full and wonderful. And it's just that not every word can hit every single pair of ears perfectly every time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What do you have to add to that?
I had things and then I lost them.
You lost them in the sapeness of it all?
Yeah, I know. So what is, this is more of a kind of like a kind of a personal question. Like, what is next with Toal in terms of not just, you know, creating and expanding it, but like, what do you hope to do with it? How does it kind of, how does it shape your life, especially that one versus your other created language projects?
Oh, I have a very specific answer to that, which is I'm currently working on a revised version, which I think has already been dubbed in Discord as Tool. But actually, like two, number two.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. and so there were a few things where, I mean, every once in a while, I will ignore the language for a few months at a time because I decide I don't like it anymore. And what I very recently realized is sometimes I'm just in the mood to do a different thing. Sometimes what I want to do when I'm conlanging is derive a bunch of new words, in which case it is really not the right language to work on. Sometimes I want to do a translation or something like that, in which case it probably is. But part of that also was there were certain things about the phonology I just didn't really care for. Mm. One of which was the ejective P, which I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know why that was in there. It's gone now.
Oh.
And a nice thing about this is that I can make a revision and just change every instance of an ejective P to a Q. It now has the uvular stuff, and it's so much better. A few other little changes that I had been sort of thinking about. But I still really like the structure of it, the grammar, basically. So I'm keeping that. I think most of the words are the same, at least so far. I will probably just sort of keep it as like this back burner language generally. I used it in the first conlang relay that I did, and that went pretty well. That was the one, that was the last LCC one, and that was the one where the language I was translating from was UNLS, which I then went and continued to learn and have written things in at this point now. And I don't really think about. I don't know that I would use Toll in a relay again. It's my impression was that it was actually very easy to translate from, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing, but maybe not quite in the spirit of it. And I have other languages which I think just work better for that. But I like going back to it for little translations, or even for longer ones where, like I translated the whole first, I think, two paragraphs of The Hobbit into Toll at some point, which was a fairly big project and would have been nearly impossible with any of my other conlangs because of just how much work that would be. But it was nice to have this whole block of text. I was like, wow, look at that thing I made, you know? Things like that. For a while, I was actually using that for like a diary. That was difficult because that did require making a lot of new words just for every entry and was kind of not. I think that was at an earlier stage where I was thinking that this is like not just that I want to have made this language, but that I want to use it daily. That's not really the goal anymore because I've realized that's just not the side of conlanging that I'm in, as interested in. But, I don't know if that really answers the question.
No, I mean, it gives an impression. I get that. Yeah. What were you just talking about? Oh, I just want to mention really quickly, ejective P is, I find personally, to be the easiest ejective, and I felt like
Really? Oh, it's the
the
most
most likely.
difficult.
And yeah, it turns out cross-linguistically across the board, ejective P is the rarest, and K is supposed to be the most likely and the easiest. And I always
K is
found
definitely
that
the easiest for
I
me.
found that backwards. I think
It's
just
interesting.
makes sense. It's so easy because you can build up so much pressure behind your lips, and they just need to be closed. And so ape op eep op. Oh, love it. I felt betrayed when I learned about the phonetics. I was like, how can that one be the most rare?
Funny.
And then it was like, and in fact, implosive B was the most common,
Yeah, it's
implosive. And
backwards.
I was like, oh, don't like it. But
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about implosives. Maybe I'll use one in a language someday.
by the way, are there central vowels in Toll?
Well, there's a schwa and there's the low central vowel, but yeah. Actually, so to get a little bit more specific, I don't know how much time we have exactly, but the vowel system for Tawil is like the one thing that is maybe the least naturalistic about it. Not the specific set of vowels, but the way that they work, which is that a noun which is either the subject or object, basically the core case, is marked, which means that the vowel changes, but it will depend on the vowel. So it's a non-concatenative thing. But specifically, the marked vowels are like, what's the word? Is polar the right thing I'm thinking? Like
Okay, like cardinal.
e u a o a. So basically, at the periphery of the vowel space, and then the unmarked ones are just slightly centralized versions. So I, e, o, u. Some schwa-ish thing. And when I started, I actually had this idea that like there would be different valid options. So like if you wanted to instead do a five vowel system but with a length contrast for the marking, that would also be correct. Or if you wanted to do a tonal thing, it could be high vowels are marked, low vowels are not. And it was sort of like in the orthography, it's a diacritic that says that this vowel is marked. So you can represent that however you want. In practice, I found that I always ended up doing the peripheral or centralized vowels anyway. And so I sort of just made that how it works. But yeah.
I have an
That.
idea
Okay.
for our phonology. And get ready
Ooh.
for this. It's going to be David's nightmare, and yet it's going to make sense once you hear the full idea.
Okay.
A
I'm excited.
language whose system of vowels, at the proto stage anyway, or at the current stage, but just with some synchronic variation, are all central. So only central vowels in a language. But where they actually end up getting produced is more dependent on the consonants. And so like velar, uvular are going to pull them backwards.
Yeah.
And anything at the high level will be interpreted as the high round vowel. It's just normally central if it's like in an open syllable or, you know, nothing affecting it. But if it gets, you know, round consonants produced more towards the front of the mouth, it gets pulled up to like an E. But if it's more towards the back of the mouth, it gets pronounced more like ooh, but like it's allophonically all the same thing. And so underlyingly, it's all central vowels.
Yeah, this is actually the theory behind the Caucasian languages. So Kabardian Adige.
Not even original.
So
I may as well have just called Jonathan Citizen Kane.
They hypothesized that there were only two proto-vowels, barred I and schwa.
And then it just got...
Yeah.
Okay, but still, this would be a way to make, I feel it, David-approved all-central vowel language is that then the allophones pull it in some direction or another, but it doesn't super matter how E or U the vowel is because it's the high-rounded vowel, and like it's going to get heard the same way by the speakers. It's just going to get pulled all over the place by the consonants.
I actually did this in a language.
You know what? Just,
I'm so sorry.
I'm done. You and Jonathan talk.
That's a brilliant idea. Like
you, it was brilliant because you had it already.
Well, I mean, and it wasn't me that created it. It was the world.
There's the Caucasian speakers. Yes. Okay.
No, that's...
Oh, wow. Man,
you just came up with that, right? That's brilliant.
Thank you.
That's brilliant. Man.
My very unoriginal idea was brilliant. Thank you.
I was going to say, your system reminded me of one of my very, very favorites, which is from Afrihili. You know about Afrihili?
I don't think I do.
It was brilliant. It was an African oxlang created in the 60s. And I don't know why it died or why it didn't catch on, but basically they were like, you know, Esperanto is very European. Let's create not an, you know, a universal auxiliary language. Let's just create a Pan-African auxiliary language. And it was called Afrihili. And they had what is called the vowel triangle. And it was a 7-vowel system. And the vowel triangle had like, and basically it was like this. It was 6 vowels. And so it was like E, A, and then, okay, let me see if I can remember. Shoot. I think it was E-A-A-O-O. And in the middle was E.
Oh,
and basically, the singular version of all nouns had vowels that were opposites on the triangle. So if I had that, right, Jesse's...
You mean opposite from the plural, or?
Oh, here it is.
Here we go. Okay, so yeah, I had it wrong. The vowels were correct, but I had them in the wrong order. So if you had a singular of a noun, let's just say that this, I don't know, I'm just making up a word, it's not a real word, but if there was a word like akpano, say that meant banana, that would be one banana. And to pluralize it, you'd say akpana, where you just make it the same vowel. But it's always the opposite. So the opposites are a and o, u and e, a and aw, and then e being in the middle, for example. So if akpano is banana, akpana was bananas, ekbene is banana-like. It's an adjective.
And so, so omulenzi is boy.
Oh, perfect. A real example.
Imulenzi is boys. Oluga language. Aluga languages.
Oh, and it's the first
yes, the prefix.
The first vowel that changes. Yeah. All right.
Which makes sense because a lot of African languages
have the noun classes.
The noun classes,
right.
Which really have the number as well.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that makes a ton of sense. So there were there was basically all this, and that was the nouns were the ones I remember, and also the adjective formation. But that vowel triangle played a role in every single part of the grammar, where it was crucially these switches between, but not randomly, right? It wasn't just like, oh, the vowel changes. It's like they have these pairs and they change that way, right? That was what nice. What your system reminded me of.
Yeah, that's interesting. Really cool. So yeah, I was talking about nouns, right? But the same alternation works with verbs also. So yeah. Like a finite verb is marked, a non-finite verb is unmarked, basically. And so like adjectives are, you know, participles, things like that. And so it's sort of like that basic rule combined with just a few things about word order. That's like the entirety of the grammar of the language, and then everything sort of follows from there. And it's sometimes like a fun little puzzle to just logically work out like how you express a certain thing. And it's fun to break away also from like expected patterns of grammar. Like, I don't know, just experimenting with things. Like one idea that I have, which probably has some precedent somewhere, I don't know, is that all in total, any verb that indicates like opinion is actually a transitive verb, where the object is the person who holds that opinion, which is sort of backwards from what you might think. So like if you're saying I like something, the thing is the subject, I is the object. And what that does is, because you could just drop the object of any transitive verb, if you drop that, that's, you're saying it's good, it's liked, basically. And so, like, things like that, which probably would not have occurred to me if I was going for naturalism, like, that's the kind of thing I like about that language and that sort of method of conlanging.
How interesting.
Or, like, something similar, which is from Unnels, which I sort of stole for Steffa, is, like, a word for parent is essentially a transitive verb. It's A is the parent of B. Mm-hmm. And that's because in Unnels, basically all the, anything that looks like a noun on paper is actually a verb meaning to be that thing. Mm. But yep. Because parent is about a relationship between a parent and a child, it's very explicitly a verb that has these two, you know, attachment points. And so I have the same idea in Steffa, which is obviously presented differently because it's a musical language instead of a non-linear two-dimensional one, but it's that same idea. But I don't expect that there's probably natural languages out there where parent is exclusively a verb.
Not a verb necessarily, but transitivity in nouns is something that has precedence in natural languages, and it's specifically with terms like that. And so it's not the case that it's a verb, but it is the case that it requires special marking to be used on its own. It is expected to have some sort of possession indicated. I don't remember if Nahuatl is one of these where it's obligatorily possessed, but basically the idea of the, if you look up a transitive noun in the literature, it's referring to nouns that have obligatory possession in order to be used and can't be used without that, unless there's some special strategy used to turn it into like either a different a word of a different type to derive it, or it co-occurs with some sort of special marking to indicate, we don't know who the possessor or possessee is.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I've encountered that maybe under a different name, because that sounds very familiar, but I don't recognize the term. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's always the fun thing too, because, you know, one linguist will come up with and say, this is the best term for this. And then they'll keep using it. And then the consensus will be, oh, okay, I think, but this term makes more sense. And then that first linguist is like, I reject that, and I am going to spend the rest of my career using this term and only this term. And then it just keeps being like that. Anyway. All right. Final thoughts on anything or visions of what's to come? And first of all, also... you have two YouTube channels, yeah?
Well, I have one where I have posted Luvanote videos, but other than that, I have one Conlang YouTube channel.
Oh, yeah, you have one Conlang YouTube channel, but the other one has a cat on it.
Okay, yeah.
But your channels are, is the channel actually called Luvuna Langs, or?
Yeah, the Conlang one is Luvuna Langs, L-E-V-U-N-A Langs.
Yep.
And then I don't know what the other one is, but that's the one that's associated with the account that I'm usually using in chat on YouTube, so.
Yeah. But yeah,
Luvuna Langs also on Tumblr and Blue Sky. Yes. So I guess the thing I want to say, which is just reiterating that if you, the listener, are someone who's struggling to make decisions in making a naturalistic Conlang or, doing, a diachronic Conlang, I really, really, really highly encourage you to give it a try, to set that aside. Make a language, even just a little sketch that just is it can be some very small but self-contained project.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be able to express anything. It just, give it a try. I think it will be very enlightening. So.
And I love seeing projects like that. And if I can just, once again, beg for submissions, if you ever have some, especially small projects that are really neat and really kind of experimental, I would love to put stuff like that up on Fiat Lingua. Aching for it.
Aching. Wow.
Achy breaky lane. You gonna do it?
No.
Okay.
Anyway. Well, thank you, Jonathan.
This was a little bit... I don't know what's happening over there. This is a little bit rambly. I was hoping that I would find my points a little bit better, but I think I said what I wanted to say, more or less.
No, and of course, it's you can always come back.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll have some more specific things to say if I do.
Yeah, Latuna.
David. Anyway. to all, Latuna, Luvuna. Yeah. Anyway, David is now on stupid dad joke puns.
Yeah.
And he's getting further and further away from the mark. And so I think we should end this.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Well, thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Something new next time. But until then, stay grammar.
Stay grammar.